Group Captain Griffiths, Reel 1. Please, could you tell me how you came to work for SOE in the first place?
I was, at the time, when I began to realize what SOE were doing, I was at a radar, we'll use the modern word, radar research establishment. We were working on what is now known as Rebecca Eureka. And in this work, briefly, you could, in an aircraft, home on a beacon from a fair distance and actually find where the beacon was. Now, knowing that this was being worked on for RAF Thamesford, where the two squadrons, 138 and 161 squadron, were based, I applied to join these squadrons. And this was accepted. I'd been in Singapore, so I didn't get into the war to get back home until September. June after Dunkirk, that's right. Then I'd been on this, and I thought it time I got cracking operationally. So I was posted in the April to Thamesford.
This was April 43,
I think. Yes, April 43, to take over a flight of 138 Squadron. That was on Halifax's. And previous to this, we'd had a black Lysander sent to us, and I'd been flying this. It had a ladder on the side, permanently fixed. It had an overload tank between the front wheels, and of course the Lysander wasn't. It didn't take a great deal of intelligence to work out what it was going to be used for. This must have been maybe early 1941. I've got the date somewhere, but this Lysander was at Thamesford, which was its normal base, but they flew from Tangmere, and it was picked up from us at RAF Christchurch, which was right on the south coast, by a French-speaking Englishman. And so the stage was set for the Lysander work. However, I went to 138 Squadron, and this was Halifax's. My first trip was many ways deceiving. It was with a Canadian whom I knew, called Rutledge, and I think I learnt more on the one trip than I learnt any other way in how to survive.
What did you learn?
We visited France and Belgium on the first trip, and I think we did four or five drops, two of men and three of containers, to various points. It was during the full moon, and it was so intriguing. He had a very fine navigator called Al Roach, and the principle that Rutledge expounded to me was that if you don't get lost, you don't get shot at. He had been on the task for quite some time, and he and Hal Roach were a very powerful combination. Neither of them spoke very much. They could read each other's minds, and we had a most beautiful trip crossing the Channel, not far from Brighton, and in to roughly the Timber Wood where the Battle of Cressy was fought the other side. The moon-etched countryside rolled by underneath. Nobody shot at us. We dropped two drops somewhere north of Paris. We worked up into Belgium, did one there. And then towards the end of the night, there were some parcels to be dropped off in the sewage farm at the Palace of Versailles. So we came round the south of Paris, and of course Versailles is well into the town, and then maybe it would be by this time 3:30 in the morning at 4 o'clock. We dropped off our packages into this sewage farm. It excited me because to do a thing like this in the middle of the night, it was quite intriguing, because when you really analyze it, not many people want to be hanging around a sewage farm even in daylight. They certainly don't want to be at night. So we dropped off our packages and they went beautifully into where the lights were put for us. They held torches and we dropped on these torches and the packages went, I presume, into that part of the sewage farm which was still fairly liquid. And then hey-ho to back home. And
was there anything about the way in which Rutledge accomplished the operation that surprised you?
He had also, he'd been working on radar research, and he was just as much aware of the secrets of the game to lose yourself in the ground returns with the aircraft. It is as true today as it was years ago, that the Indian who crawls through the brushwood or crop is as hard to hit as if he stands up, he'll get killed. And with aircraft, again, if you can keep low down and lose your echo in the ground returns, they can't get at you. They might get a brief glimpse, but it's not enough to follow. And so, and I knew that 250 feet, even with a fighter on your tail, we were safe. At that period in time, of course, the heat-reflecting missiles weren't invented, which could home onto your exhaust gases. But it was a very safe job. But you had to know where you were. And having had this wonderfully smooth trip, which was always a pleasure, I started on my own, trying to set a good example as a squadron commander, and the first few trips weren't good at all. We got shot at, we got slightly lost, even a couple hundred yards would make a difference, and but we got better and better. One night we had gone in and we had three men to drop, and this discouraged me tremendously. Later on I took to strafing trains in a very accurate manner where we could stop them without hurting anybody. But on this occasion it was Forge, F-O-R-G-E-S, Forge Junction. We saw a stop train in the junction, and we were very low, and suddenly he opened up. It was obviously a flak train. There must have been many guns on it. And we were hit. In fact, I was waiting any minute for fuel to cut to one of the engines, but I had a very good flight engineer with me at that time, who's now running a pub in Cambridge, in Norfolk. that he was able to cross feed and use up the fuel that we were losing so fast. And then the dispatcher came through and said that one of the Joes, that's the agent in the back, had lost his ear and was bleeding badly. And what were the well, as a matter of fact, the expression he used, it looks like a butcher's shop in the back. None of the RAF crew were hurt, fortunately, but we turned around and we came home. And
where is this place, Forges?
F-O-R-G-E-S. I'd say it's about 25 miles inside France, having crossed over at the point that Rutledge had showed me. In the business, we got to know the good crossing points, and I never had any trouble with that. You could always jump the coast by going to 7,000 and down again quickly. You could keep out of the range of light flak. And we became expert at this. The one thing you got to watch was the Channel Islands. The Channel Islands were like battleships. In fact, they were regarded as battleships. They had tremendous guns. And that is how that coastline was defended. And if you kept at 250 feet and then came in on the, I would say, the east side of the peninsula of Cherbourg and over Carentan, in fact, indeed over the invasion beaches, you could get in quite neatly that way. Anyway, it's a strange thing, but the after we'd landed, the petrol was still pouring out of the aircraft, and the medical officer on the station sent the casualties off to hospital in Henlo, and then a medical orderly who'd been told to clean up all the syringes and the various things we'd used in our first aid kit, found the ear of this man. And this was 9 o'clock in the morning. And the ear was rushed down to, packed in ice, rushed down to the hospital and sewn on. And it was quite okay. He got his ear back. I don't know what his hearing was like, but it was quite a gory do. Now, that was very early on, but we'd learnt a tremendous lesson there. If you want to pick a train, we weren't looking for strafing a train at that time. We were really trying to do these five jobs in a night. And we got better and better as a crew, and my navigator was especially good. And it went very smoothly. With this work of SOE, we did various places. You could name almost all the countries of Europe. Norway from Thamesford was a little tricky, a lot of sea crossing, and in Norway they were always up in the mountains. Now, it had to be in the winter time, because summertime there's not enough daylight. So Norway, Poland, and Denmark were out in the summer. You couldn't fly from Thamesford and get there and back. And then for when winter came on, it was approaching, say in August, Polish crews came in, and they used to do the Polish work with us, with the British as well. And it was quite intriguing because they were marvellously aggressive. I sometimes questioned my own aggression after I had the Poles. They would go as briefed, fly across through the Skagerrak, tip of Sweden, to Bornholm Island, and then in Poland they would navigate by the POW camps, because they and the Geneva Convention had to have their lights on, and they do their drops as far east of the Vistula, which was a long way to go, and then they'd come back. Now the British would come back the proper way as briefed, and you'd be very surprised to come back and find that the Poles were about an hour ahead of you, because they came back from the middle of Germany, and though they never had a bullet left, they, having got rid of their job, the packages to be dropped or the men, they would go on a shoot-up in Germany. And of course, in many places, the aircraft got hit, and then we had to repair them, and you had to sort of, they were hard to discipline. You had to say, look, we want this aeroplane back tomorrow in good condition. They were difficult, and yet you couldn't help but admire them. They were always saluting. Even if the dispatcher brought you up a cup of tea, he'd go and salute. Oh yes, they were strange chaps, but quite good and at their job. Right. Communication with the Poles wasn't very easy. Funnily enough, if you were giving duel and showing them how it should be done, you could cope with a little bit of German. I found they all seemed to understand German. There was a man called Kroll, K-R-O-L-L, who was the Polish liaison officer. And the only way to get discipline across to them, if there was something you didn't like or you'd mention, you'd tell them, and when Kroll was there, he would translate it, and then it would get across. It's rather like, I always think, in the army, if you want to discipline a Scottish soldier, you must do it through a Scottish officer. It's quite extraordinary. Otherwise, they would smile, and you'd assume they'd listen, they'd understood, but they'd go off and do it again. But they were magnificent chaps. I've never known people with a greater desire to commit suicide in some ways. I briefed one lot. We were going in to do a job in France, and I said, you two will go ahead, and after we've got across the channel at a certain point, you climb up to 7,000 feet and then come straight down afterwards. And I followed them, all in line ahead, and you could see their exhaust flames. And when the moment came to climb, they didn't climb. So we tried to keep radio silence. I climbed up, hoping the rear gunners would say something about it, but the Poles kept low down, and then they went in on the French coast, and the first one got shot down. The second one got a few holes in him, but they seemed to want to fight and not deliver stuff, maybe to France. They would go to Poland and go the proper way without getting shot up. But, however, that's how things were.
It sounds as though they might have been better in bomber command than in doing secret work.
And, but they were good. There's no doubt about it. There was no turning back with the Poles. Then that, of course, was winter jobs. Early on in the spring, it was just dark enough to do some jobs over there. The Austrian trips, which were as far as Austria, naturally, they would be a two-day trip. Rutledge, this man I first flew with, he used to do them with this fellow, Al Roach, and they would fly in across France and have a quiet trip, as he said, to Lake Como in Italy. And from Lake Como, they would climb. and they would do astronav, because there always seemed to be cloud. Now, the man they used to take used to be dropped off in a bend in the Vistula, in the great river. Come to me in a minute. And they would have to let down sometimes through cloud. Now, there's nothing harder to an aeroplane than a cloud full of mountain, and it needs tremendous accuracy of navigation to do a let down in a mountain area. But he used to do this, and then, having dropped this man off in the bend of the
Danube,
that's right, they'd turn round and come back and down to Malta. There wasn't enough daylight to get back to England, so they go down to Malta and, as he used to put it, have a very military day. No sleep at all at Malta, and you were just itching to refuel and get away again in the dark, back up to Thamesford on the second night. But what with the bombing and problems in Malta, it was better to get away.
You were dropping agents in Austria?
No, I never did. This was the but that my flight did. And this is the way it was done. Now, we got very restricted, of course, with the summer and the lack of daylight. That was a bit of a nuisance. But we could always do, we could do Holland, but that was a very quick one. You had to be over the coast, in and out again in about 30 minutes. There wasn't enough darkness to cover you. We needed, of course, moonlight to a degree, because without the moon we couldn't really check on our navigation. The moon and water were the secrets of the whole business. I think you could say that if the people had good torches, and in some areas they had bonfires, and you could run, say, 15 minutes and be within 2 or 3 miles of the point you wanted. Now, the men on the ground could get you to them by using, they had their torches, and their torches would have a circular piece of cardboard, or anything would do, so that that was directed at the sound. And when these torches came on, generally an L pattern, you could then home on it, and sometimes if you had time and it was not a very vulnerable area, you could actually circle and then drop, because we used to give a code letter for the day, and the way these chaps were alerted the other side was on the BBC long wave, 5 to 1 in the morning, in the that's 1300 hours news time, and then at night in the evening 5 to 6, that's 1755. The first, and the message that was passed, and many old people would remember it, would be something, say it was France, it would be something like, Clément le Chat est bien sorti, means nothing to you and me, but over the other side there would be someone, which meant that we were coming, and we were coming to this field on that night, because they would get messages asking for equipment, and they'd say, these messages would list what they wanted, and they would give the map reference on the Michelin map of where the place was, and we would Then, if it was a landing with a Lysander, we would arrange for a pilot, the other side, and sadly, one of them was a Frenchman who wasn't too... He was a very good pilot, but I've always... We always thought there was a little something funny about him. And he
was
would...
Vericourt,
that's it, yes. Then they would... The quick way to find things out, they gave the reference. We sent out a Spitfire from the photographic unit. They took a photograph of it. This is for landing. And then we would get someone, a pilot, to walk the ground. Because if you're going to land an aeroplane in a field in a foreign land, in fact, anywhere, you walk it on your two flat feet first. It is hopeless saying, oh, that's lovely, I stood on the hedge and had a look. It's not good enough. You've got to watch. So we had them surveyed in this manner. And within, if they'd chosen their field, within a week, or even quicker if it was urgent, we could have all this done. Photographic reconnaissance, have the field walked. Okay, we accept it. And I'm now wandering slightly, but I may say that the Lysander was a superb aircraft in this respect. It was made for the army, for army cooperation. And indeed, you could use it if you wanted to for picking up messages, because it had the hooks on some of them. And but it could land in a small field. It was designed, a specification wanted it to do a very vertical landing and a very steep climb on takeoff. But it was found to use it in daylight and try and scrap with the enemy, a waste of time. But moonlight came into its own. You see the torches and you could put the flaps down and you point it at the ground and it would arrive. And you could taxi back on the lights, get to the beginning again, swing round, two passengers out, two passengers in, and you open the throttle again, and you could be airborne from wheels down, wheels on the ground, to wheels off the ground, 90 seconds, the changeover of passengers. It was a magnificent aircraft for that, and it could climb like mad. That was the Lysander. The Hudson was unfortunately a higher wing loading, and you've got to be very careful of the condition of the ground, or she could get bogged. But nevertheless, it did quite a sound job, and you could carry up to eight if you wanted to, and you needed a lot more space. But fortunately, there were many places in France which, if they weren't obstructed, were made quite good. Well, in fact, some were used as civilian airfields before the war. Lons-le-Saunier was one of them. Now,